My name is Tom Gleason. I'm in the civil engineering department. And I'm a very short opening act to our invited speaker, and I wanted to use just a couple minutes to introduce a couple things that are going on here at McGill and just to really just publicly thank the faculty for this initiative. It's been really great. I've been here 3 years, and I've felt really supported in the various efforts I'm interested in and trying to do in active learning, and I really appreciate that. I also like to actually do something rather than just talking. So this is one of the many tools I use in teaching. I don't want you to get the idea that active learning is only just technology, but we do often use a lot of technology. So if you feel like it, you can follow the directions on this slide to go to this website, log in as a student using this number also up on the board here, and answer two simple questions. I would like to read blog posts about, and that's a multiple choice question, and I might read a blog about teaching and supervision if, and that's a short answer question. And I thought I'd use this time as have a captive audience of people who are at least interested in active learning to get your thoughts on this. Also wanted to use this time to introduce a few things that are going on at McGill in the digital world. The first is a broader initiative called the Teaching Blog, or Teaching for Learning. It's a Wiki Spaces, a WordPress blog, and there's a number of different authors in different disciplines and different departments, and I'm just one of those. And I suggest you check it out. And I also wanted to use this opportunity to do sort of a soft introduction or a soft opening for my blog, which is Water Underground. So I'm going to be blogging about teaching, supervision, what I do in research, and which is really focused on groundwater and groundwater systems around the world. So it's a mix of kind of technical stuff about groundwater and teaching and learning. And I always, in the last 6 months, every talk I've given, I've challenged people to concisely and in lay language, communicate the message of a talk through a tweet. So I'm putting out a challenge, and I will try to do the same in 140 characters. We'll try to summarize Michael's presentation and tweet it, and we'll see what happens and start the conversation and keep the conversation going. And with that, I'll stop and pass the floor over to Andy, who's going to introduce the speaker.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom. So my name is Andrew Cook. I'm the chair of the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering here at McGill. And it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to the Faculty of Engineering's inaugural Active Learning Conference. It's wonderful to see so many of you here today to engage in a conversation about active learning. We have a full house, that's fantastic. And attendees are here not just from McGill Engineering, but also from other departments at McGill and from other neighboring universities. Il me donne un grand plaisir de vous accueillir ici chez nous à McGill. Et j'espère sincèrement qu'aujourd'hui n'est que le début d'une discussion qui va continuer à plusieurs reprises dans l'avenir. I believe that most of us are here, perhaps because we're busy skeptics, and also because we have a keen interest in improving our teaching, and perhaps even more importantly, in improving the learning of the students in our classes. And perhaps you are here because you've heard about active learning and want to learn more about it, or perhaps you've been implementing active learning for a while. In any case, I know that many of us realize that there are better ways for students to learn than simply being lectured at. However, it sometimes seems to be a big and daunting step sometimes to give up some control in our class and attempt something other than lecturing. And unfortunately, in many cases, I know also it's not as if students are always clamoring for it, for an end to lecture. Sometimes I feel that the students are a little bit like patients visiting a doctor, that if they're not prescribed 3 lectures a week to take, then the doctor isn't, or the professor isn't doing his or her job, whereas in many cases, perhaps a prescription for learning might be some rigorous exercises. So in any case, in a couple of minutes, I will introduce our keynote speaker, Professor Michael Prince, who will be speaking about active learning for busy skeptics, and I'm sure he's going to inspire us to keep trying to make changes to how we teach. Before I do that, I'd just like to explain a little bit about what the Teaching and Learning Enhancement Program has been doing in the Faculty of Engineering. So Tom just gave a snapshot of some of the many things he's been doing, but there's been much more else happening as well. So the program was initiated 2 years ago, thanks to a very generous donation to the faculty, and it's intended to promote reflection on teaching and learning, not just by professors, but also by teaching assistants and students. And it has already had, it's already undertaken several initiatives, some of which have had a major impact on large numbers of students. For example, instructors teaching the faculty-wide courses FAC 100, which is the Introduction to the Engineering Profession, and FAC 400, which is our course in engineering professional practice, have introduced techniques such as peer review, the use of the learning catalytic software, and others. And this would not have been possible without the support of Dr. Maria Pajuela, and other staff from McGill's Teaching and Learning Services, who provided wide-ranging advice to professors and who attended many of the classes to provide feedback and input to the instructors. Other programs also provided mini-grants to professors to introduce some new tools and techniques, and some of which is focused on technology, others focus on methods such as reflective writing. The programs also organized brand bag lunches, which have brought professors together to share ideas and to swap inspiration, and has brought in external speakers from some of our neighboring CEGEPs, where instructors have been making use of active learning for many years. It's been active with teaching assistants to develop better training tools, and with undergraduate students in order to help them to understand better what is meant by active learning, so when they are confronted in the classroom, they don't just think the professor stopped teaching. And finally, I'm pleased to report that 3 presentations arising from this program will be given at the forthcoming Canadian Engineering Educational Association Conference in Calgary this June. So this program's been very busy. And this talk today is a very important part of this program. So without further ado, I'm very pleased to introduce our visiting speaker, Dr. Michael Prince. Dr. Prince is a professor of chemical engineering and Rook Professor of Engineering at Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. He did his bachelor's at WPI and did grad studies at Berkeley. He serves as co-director of the National Effective Teaching Institute and How to Engineer Education, which are workshops that happen twice a year around North America. And his current research examines how to increase the use of research-based instructional strategies by engineering faculty, as well as focusing specifically on repairing persistent student misconceptions. So I should also point out that one of Dr. Prince's papers, in which he surveyed active learning programs, was assigned as reading to the first participants in the Effective Teaching Learning Strategies program. And so we all enjoyed reading it. So in a way, he's a godfather of this program, perhaps unknowingly. And so it's particularly special to have him here with us today. So I'd like to welcome my Prince.
Good. Thanks, and thanks to all of you for coming out. So the talk this morning is entitled Active Learning for Busy Skeptics, and there's 2 things I'm trying to get at in the title. One is, I know you're busy. Trust me. I'm an academic. I know all the things that are pulling at your time. And so even if you're convinced that active learning is a nice thing, if you go, yeah, active learning is a nice thing, but I barely have time to survive now. There's no way I have time to do something in addition to what I'm already doing. This talk is geared for you because there's a lot of active learning techniques that are, in fact, quite easy to do that require very little preparation time. And in our time together this morning, I'm going to focus on those. The other piece that I want to hit is the skeptical part, which is, a lot of times when I talk about active learning, people say, look, there's nothing new about active learning. I mean, Socratic learning is active learning, and Socrates lived a long time ago. What's the big deal about active learning now? And so I'll talk about kind of the reasons why we would think about working more active learning into our traditional classrooms, what's new about it, what's not so new about it, and then all the reasons why, as a faculty member, you might honestly think that this is a good choice for you to make. So if I don't do that in the time that we have together, poke back, all right? Because the point of our time together is to convince you that active learning is something that there's a reason to do it, and that if you chose to do it, you could be successful at it. If I don't convince you of those 2 things in our time together, then you're not going to do it. And the whole point of our time together is to encourage you to actually do those things. So don't be shy about poking back. Okay. With that said, I want to clarify very much up front what I'm not here to do, okay? Which is, I am not here to tell you how to teach for a couple of reasons. One, you wouldn't listen. That is, I have never had any luck telling an academic to do anything. And I don't expect to have any more luck telling you. That is, you're going to teach in a way that seems good to you, all right? So if I want you to use active learning, I need to convince you that active learning seems good to you. But the other reason why I'm not here to tell you how to teach is that, honestly, I don't know how you should teach, because I don't know you, and I don't know your goals, and I don't know your students, and I don't know the environment in which you teach. I don't know your strengths as an individual instructor, and I don't know your limitations. Right? You know all those things, and I don't. All right. So if the presentation this morning is not about kind of telling you how to teach, what's it about? It's about kind of clarifying what active learning is. Right? We can't talk about whether you want to do something or not if you don't know what it is. We'll talk about the reasons why you want to do it, and I'll share some ideas. All right, so when I'm sharing those ideas, hopefully you'll hear some ideas that sound good to you. If you hear an idea that sounds like it's a little crazy or out on the limb for you, just don't do it. I have a colleague back at Bucknell who teaches civil engineering, and he teaches material science. And within his material science class, he has students do skits. He'll say, Maria, you're a metal. Andy, you're a ceramic. Go into a bar, have a conversation, learn about each other. All right? It may be good pedagogy. There is no way I could do that with a straight face. That is, I'm a middle-aged engineering professor. That does not suit my personality at all. So I don't do it. Same thing here. If I'm talking about a flavor of active learning, if I'm talking about it, there's research to support it. If I'm talking about it, there's reason to think that if I were to try to use this in my class, people would learn more than they would in a traditional classroom. That does not mean that you need to run off and do it. If it's not a good fit for you, it's not a good fit for you. Hopefully 5 minutes later, I'll talk about something which is a good fit for you, and we can talk about that. Okay, so what is active learning? These are a couple of my students acting, thank God. But let's start the conversation by clarifying what we mean by active learning, because it's a buzz phrase, and so people use it in a bunch of different ways. Active learning is anything you ask the students in your class to do. Anything you ask the students in your class to do, so long as that thing gets people to do something other than listen to you and take notes and engages them in the material. All right. So if I ask my students in class to do anything that engages them in the material other than listen to me and take notes, that's going to qualify as active learning. That's a pretty broad umbrella term. It's going to look very different in different contexts. Okay, but the two key components that you're going to look for are, one, activity. I have to ask you to do something, and that something is not listen to me and take notes. And two, whatever I ask you to do, it has to actually get people to engage with, to think about the stuff that I want you to learn in my class. If it does those two things, it'll qualify as active learning. Okay, so what does that look like? And the answer is, it depends. You know, that's a pretty broad definition for an approach to teaching. You know, it can look very, very different in practice. And so what I've tried to do here with this active learning continuum is to kind of give you a sense of the span of things. There is no way I can cover every type of active learning on a single slide. And this slide is not meant to convey every single thing that you can do with active learning. But it gives a nice overview of kind of the range of things you can do. By which I mean, all right, there are some types of active learning that are honestly pretty instructor-focused, all right, meaning that the spotlight is on me, like literally the spotlight is on me right now. And so in those types of environments, the instructor does what I'm doing right now, lecture, 90 to 95% of the time. All right, but every so often, the instructor will stop lecturing and ask the students to do something other than listen to him or her that engages them with the material. So as long as I stop my lecture two or three times for 1, 2, or 3 minutes, and ask my students to do something to engage with the material, that will qualify as simple active learning. And it's the format that I'm using for our presentation this morning. But it's still fairly traditional. It's very appealing to faculty who like to lecture, who think they're good lecturers, who don't want to do anything radical in terms of transforming their teaching, but still want to do something a little bit more effective than what they're doing. So it's a very easy first step into doing active learning. And it's quite simple to do. On the other end of the spectrum, there are techniques like problem-based learning or project-based learning that are active and are very radical departures from a traditional classroom. All right? In simple active learning, if you stuck your head into a classroom, 9 times out of 10, you would see people doing what I'm doing right now, lecturing. But every so often, you would see students engaged in a short activity. But 9 times out of 10, it would look traditional. In some active learning techniques, like problem-based learning, if you were to stick your head in that classroom, you would almost never see the instructor doing what I'm doing now. You would almost never see them lecturing. Instead, you would see students in small groups sitting around a table, frequently with a computer, and the instructor walking around and facilitating those conversations. It actually is the way that I teach most often at home. And the irony is, I give more lectures on active learning than I actually use, you know, lectures in my classroom at home, because, you know, in a simple variation of what I'm doing here, you know, most of what I'm doing in this presentation this morning is lecturing, but every so often I'll do something else. And that would qualify as active learning. And of course, there's stuff all through the middle. The takeaway from slides like this is not The more student-centered you are, the better. The more radical you are, the better. The more active you are, the better. That is not the takeaway from a slide like this. A slide like this is meant to convey that active learning comes in a whole variety of styles and flavor. Chances are there's a style that suits you, your personality, your goals, your environment, your comfort level. And so the message is, find where you are comfortable on the spectrum and spend your time there. All right? Don't feel like if you haven't radically transformed your classes, you haven't made them active. That's not necessarily true. There's plenty of reasons why you would want to be here. And if that's you, that's just fine. Okay. Especially when I talk to engineers or an engineering audience, they go, well, Mike, that's nice. But honestly, which one of these things is best? All right? There's all kinds of different types of active learning, but really, which one's best? It's a natural question, but it's a silly question. So let me ask you, what's better, a hammer or a screwdriver? What's better, a hammer or a screwdriver? Right, it depends, right? It depends on what you're trying to do. It's the same thing for active learning. That is, some pedagogies really are designed for certain things, and so you can figure out kind of what your issue is, what part of your teaching you want to make better. If all you're trying to do is to infuse some energy, if you're tired of looking at glazed eyeballs and yawning students and you want to infuse a little bit of energy and engagement into your class to kind of keep people awake, then simple active learning may be all you need. If you're looking to develop students' open-ended problem-solving skills and their lifelong self-directed learning skills, then problem-based learning is a good pedagogy for you, because in that pedagogy, students get the practice and feedback that they need to develop their open-ended problem skills. If I'm trying to teach interpersonal skills or teamwork skills, cooperative learning is a good tool for you, because cooperative learning gives people the structure, practice, and feedback that they need to be effective team members. All right. So the goal is to try to not become religious about any particular approach. Sometimes I'm asked out to a university to consult on their educational innovations, and they've found some pedagogy, like project-based learning, and they've turned it into a fetish. And so every single class they teach is a project-based learning class. And you go, really? You know, that's like using a hammer all the time. That is, project-based learning is a tool. It is great for some things. It is not great for some other things. And so, again, I want you to think about pedagogies in a more nuanced way of it than that. I want you to think about matching up an active learning approach that's right for the situation that you find yourself in and picking that one. Okay, so I want to do a quick one with you, all right? Because a lot of times I get asked, you know, they say, Mike, I can do active learning in a class of 20 people, but if I have a fixed seat auditorium and 120 people, I can't do active learning. They have done active learning studies in mega classes of 1,400 students. It works just fine. The one problem in a large classroom is when I turn you loose to do something, you get loud, all right? So the biggest issue with getting people back is you need a signal to get them back. All right. So usually I turn the lights on and off, but really this room is not configured to turn the lights on and off all that much. So for you, I'm going to turn you loose for a brainstorming activity in about 30 seconds. I want you to talk for about 60 or 90 seconds during that activity. When I want you back, I'm going to clap my hands very loudly. So pay attention. At the end of about 90 seconds, I'm going to do everything I can to get your attention back. Here's the brainstorm that I want you to do. If you're on this side of the room or over, the middle or over, I want you to think about all the good reasons why you would do active learning, all the possible benefits that would accrue to you as the instructor or to the students in your class if you got them to actively engage in your classes in ways that go beyond listening to you and take notes. Okay? If you're on this side of the room and over, I want you to be the skeptics. I want you to tell me all the things that could go wrong. I'm going to lose control of the classroom. I'll never cover the syllabus. All the things that you can think of that would go wrong if I did active learning. All right? So find a neighbor and do it. It's a brainstorm. The goal is not quality. The goal is quantity. The more ideas you have, the better. All right? About 90 seconds. At the end of that 90-second period, I'm going to clap my hands as loudly as I can and try to get you back. Does everybody know what I want you to do? All right, go do it. Thank you. Okay, let me try to get you back. Thanks. Thanks. All right, let's at least start with the positive. I'm sure there's all kinds of concerns that people have, but let's at least start with the positive. Right here, something that came up. What's some reason why I might want to do active learning?
Students are happier with the class and more active.
Okay, people are more active and they're happier, and they might, actually just might like it. Some of our lectures can be a little dry and boring, so doing something to wake them up actually might result in some student positive attitudes. All right, I'm going to spend plenty of time in this presentation on the pluses of active learning. So I don't feel a need to kind of probe that side of the room all that much because it's a commercial for active learning. We're going to talk about all those things. It's this side of the room where I want to hear more. All the reasons why active learning is the stupidest idea on the planet and why no rational person would ever seriously think about doing it in their classes. So let's hear what you came up with. The gentleman in a shirt that's the same color as mine. Would you give me some reason why I don't want to do this?
That's about half the room. We all have the same.
That's right.
distance learning is a challenge.
Okay, so I'm trying to do an activity, and it's hard enough to get a group of people actively engaged when I'm in the room with them. But if they're somewhere else, especially if it's asynchronously and there's someone else, it can be a real challenge. Gentleman right here, what'd you come up with?
Well, we came up with the idea of the discipline. If you have a college student, mm-hmm. it'd be harder to keep their attention if they're not listening enough.
Okay. I turn them loose to talk about thermodynamics and they talk about basketball, right? I want them to stay focused and they just don't. One more. What did you come up with?
The students aren't likely to be interested in doing the activity. If they don't want a big class, they won't be individually evaluated.
That's right. It's fine for me to kind of teach in a room of 20 and call on people, because in a room of 20, you know, the odds of 5% of my being called on are real. In a room of 3,000, you know, fat chance. In a room of 300, still not much of a chance. Even in this room, if you were smart enough to hide in the back corner, the odds of my calling on you are, I have to work at that. So maybe people aren't going to engage. Okay. In a longer workshop on active learning, I would make sure that I explicitly collected all those concerns and walked through them. In our presentation this morning, which is shorter, I'm not going to do that. But that doesn't mean that at the end of the session, when we do the question and answer, if you have a particular concern, whether it's distance learning or large classes, some of those we're going to get to naturally, some of them we won't. So if I don't get to your concern naturally, feel free to raise your hand and poke me with it and have a conversation around that concern. And again, for very selfish reasons. Faculty do what faculty want to do. If I don't convince you that you can pull this off, you are not going to want to do it. And if you don't want to do it, you won't do it. All right. So if you have a concern, don't be shy of sharing that concern and make sure you get some of the feedback that you need to kind of get you over the hump. Okay? All right. The first question that I want to address, though, is why bother? As almost all of us went through programs that were fairly traditional, and all of us feel like we learned something, and people have been lecturing for 500 years, so really, why bother? Why bother to change? And the answer is a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, some of them are historical, right? That is, people started lecturing back before there were books, and so people stood up at a lecture and actually read the book because nobody else had it. That reason has disappeared. But we've been lecturing, you know, post-Gutenberg, and so why do that? And the answer is, it turns out that the people in our classes are remarkably like people, right? And by which I mean, their brains work in the ways that people's brains work. And one of the ways in which your brain works is, people have an attention span of about 10 or 12 minutes, right? What does that mean? It does not mean that you can't sit and politely pretend to listen to me for more than 10 minutes. You can, all right? What it means is, after I've been talking for about 10 or 12 minutes, you take mental vacations. You're still looking at me. And you pretend that you're paying attention, but really you're thinking about something else, what you're going to do after the presentation, that proposal you're working on, some conversation you have with your spouse. Like I said, you're looking at me and pretending to pay attention, but you're not. Okay? After that, if I'm teaching thermodynamics, I've already confused most of you anyway. You take a little mental vacation, you come back, you're even more confused than you were when you left because you've been gone for 2 minutes. And you came back and I was talking about something else. 10 minutes later, you take another mental vacation, and you were really confused when you left, and you're really, really confused when you come back, all right? And so what happens is, over the course of an hour, what you find is that hour is not very effective in terms of learning when all you're doing is presenting, all right? So there have been several studies. I've seen at least 7 of these that I've cited in my own work. Here on the y-axis, what they're looking at is the percentage of students paying attention, and they measure that in a variety of ways, and we can talk about that if you want. And here is time on the x-axis. And so what you find is that at the beginning of a lecture, you have almost everybody's attention. Not quite everybody, because they're still opening up their notebooks and chatting about last night, but you have almost everybody. And after about 2 or 3 minutes, you pretty much have everybody's attention. But then, if you keep talking straight for the course of an hour, the number of students paying attention drops and drops and drops. So after about 30 or 40 minutes of passively listening to someone talk, right? I don't care if you're looking at me and pretending to pay attention or not. The amount of actual learning that's going on is actually fairly small. Right? So the question is, what can I do about that? Because if people have an attention span of about 10 or 12 minutes, and if the rate of learning really drops after a significant period of time of lecturing, all right, I teach 8-hour workshops. You have an attention span of 10 minutes. All right? So what am I going to do about that? And the answer is lots and lots of things I can do. All right? Let's start with the simplest thing you can do. If people have an attention span of 10 minutes, one of the things you can do is that you can lecture in blocks of about 10 or 12 minutes. That is, you can walk in and provide some sort of overview about what you're going to talk about from the day and review what you did in the previous class and get people thinking about the topic. And then you can lecture for about 10 or 12 minutes, and then you could do a brief activity, and then you can lecture for 10 or 12 minutes, and you can do an activity. This slide is way more rigid than I would recommend. That is, there's nothing formulaic about teaching, and there's nothing formulaic about active learning. So I'm certainly not suggesting that you walk in, set a timer for 12 minutes. When the timer goes off, you do a brainstorming activity, all right, and do the same thing over and over again. But the basic idea of if people can pay attention for about 10 or 12 minutes, giving them information chunks of about 10 or 12 minutes is certainly one thing you can do. Not the only thing you can do, but one thing you can do. So it's a pretty simple-minded idea. The question is, does it work? Can simple that simple really work? And the answer for some of us, surprisingly, is yeah. Surprisingly, just doing something that simple can work. Here's one study. I picked this study because the intervention is just drop-dead simple. Right? All the instructor did in this study, it was a 50-minute class. And twice during the 50-minute class, for 60 seconds, the instructor just stopped talking and said, look at your notes. If there's anything unclear in your notes, turn to a neighbor and get clarification. The instructor didn't call for questions, didn't answer questions. That was the intervention. Just that simple. Might have been 90 seconds. Okay, and they looked at the impact of that simple intervention in two ways. First, they looked at short-term recall, for this study, they did a brain dump. At the end of the class, they had people write down everything they could remember from that day's class, and they went through and scored the number of correct things that they said. All right, they did long-term recall. Long-term in this case was 3 weeks, so not ridiculously long-term, but some significant period of time after the lecture. And in the class where they did the activity, the average was about 85, and when the instructor lectured straight through, the average was about 77. Okay, the takeaway from studies like this, and there are more than one, is that less can be more. That is, when faculty are afraid of doing even simple active learning, their thought is usually, look, I have a lot of stuff I want to cover. I can't stop talking for even two or three times for 1 or 2 minutes because nearly. I know that people don't learn everything that I say, right? But if you only learn half of what I say, and I say twice as much, you'll learn half of a bigger number. So if I just talk more, you'll learn more, okay? And the point of studies like this is that is not how it works. If I talk less, you will, in fact, learn more. As long as during that non-talking period I'm getting you to actively engage with the material, chances are you will learn more. Okay, humor me if you would. Everybody stand up and stretch. I'll do the same thing. You will look no sillier than I look. All right, thank you very much. Sit down. Okay, sit down. Okay, so here's the quiz question. Was that active learning? Think about it for about 5 seconds. All right, the question is, was that active learning? Raise your hand if you think it's active learning. Okay. Raise your hand if you think it wasn't active learning. All right. Raise your hand if you have no clue whether it was active learning or not. Okay. So the review question was, there are certain characteristics or components of active learning. All right. One of them is I have to ask you to do something other than listen to me and take notes. So does standing up and stretching qualify? Sure, I've asked you to do something, and that something is not standing up and listening to me and taking notes. What's the second component of active learning? Engagement. I have to actually get you to think about the thing that I want you to think about. So if I'm teaching thermodynamics and I ask you to stand up and stretch, is that active learning? No, it's not. Is it good pedagogy? Maybe. If you're like me, chances are you're a little bit more awake after the stretch than you were at the beginning, but it doesn't qualify as active learning. right? In the context of on a presentation on active learning, where the instructor uses it to differentiate what's active learning and what's not active learning, does it count as active learning? The answer is yeah, it does, because I turned it into an active learning technique. But the reason I bring it up is a lot of the times when faculty are concerned about, you know, kind of the active learning stuff, and they go, really, Mike, my textbook is 1,400 pages. I got a lot of stuff I have to cover. I don't have time for this cutesy turn to your neighbor, 2-minute activity stuff. One of the takeaways is, if what you're doing in that 2 minutes is a cutesy thing that doesn't get students to think about thermodynamics, then it doesn't count as active learning in your thermodynamics class. As those 2 minutes are not a vacation from whatever the topic is that you happen to be teaching. Active learning, done right, gets people to actually think about and engage with the topic of your lecture or your class. All right, so it is not a vacation from the topic that you're teaching. If it is if it's a vacation from your topic, it's not good active learning. Okay. The fact that engagement matters is no surprise. If you ask any room of people, do I want my students to be engaged, or would I rather have different disengaged students, the answer to that question is obvious. What can be surprising sometimes is the degree to which engagement actually results in more learning. So I'm going to show you a very messy slide, but I'm showing it to you for a reason. All right, let me take a minute to walk through what's on this slide so you get the takeaway message. This is a slide looking at about 6,000 physics students in a variety of different environments. All you really need to know about this slide are two things. One, the y-axis measures learning. The higher up you are on the y-axis, the more people in that environment learned. The other thing you need to take away from this is that the green symbols are any flavor of active learning, any environment where the instructor did something to actively engage the students in their class. And the red dots are symbols are all traditional lectures. And there's two things I want you to notice on this graph. One, on average, people in the active and learning environments learn twice as much as the people in the traditional classes. And I want to pause and say that again, because it's an important finding. On average, people in the active learning environments learn twice as much as people in the traditional classrooms. That's a pretty significant learning gain, right? Secondly, a lot of times I talk to faculty who have absolutely no training at all in education. That's me. Right? I've been doing this for about a dozen years now, but my training is chemical engineering. My thesis area was bubble coalescence and breakup and turbulent flow. I knew more about bubbles than anyone had a right to know when I started teaching, and almost nothing about teaching. Right? So the question is, maybe active learning works, but I think I'm a pretty good lecturer, and I have no clue whether I would be good at active learning. Maybe I'm going to suck at it. Maybe I'm just going to be bad at doing active learning, and I'm going to do more harm than good. All right? This slide is meant to address that. I want you to look at the very worst active learning environments on this slide and realize that the very worst active learning environments are no worse than the traditional classes. That is, the odds of you trying some active learning and having it result in less learning are very, very small. The odds of it resulting in more learning are very, very high. That is, educational research will never tell John what teaching on Monday with any particular student is going to achieve. That's not the nature of educational research. What educational research tells you is the odds. It says, I'm going to walk into class next Friday and I'm going to do something. I can do A or I could do B. Which one has greater odds that students in my class will learn more? And the result from decades of research on active learning is that the odds are much, much higher if you do something to actively engage your students than if you don't. Okay? So the takeaway is, you should try this. That is, chances are it's going to work, and the odds of it not working in terms of learning effectiveness are, in fact, very, very small. Okay, that's the commercial for it. We actually haven't talked about different ways that you could actually use active learning in your classes, especially in an engineering class. So let me go through some simple things that you could do that would qualify as active learning. One, the one-minute paper, fairly common technique. How many people in the room are already familiar with one-minute paper? All right. Again, it's a fairly common technique, but let me share it for the most of you who are not. In a one-minute paper, about 2 minutes before your class is over, you stop talking and you say, take out a piece of paper, and take 1 minute and answer one of the following three questions. So let me go through what those three questions are. The first question you might ask is, write down the muddiest point from today's class, the most confusing point from today's class. Okay, I don't care if I'm teaching a room of 200 people. They hand out that piece of paper on the way out the door, and that's their ticket for getting out of the room. And I walk back to my office, and as I'm walking back to my office, I skim through the first 20. I don't have to read them all. Skim through the first 20, and I figure out the one that comes up the most often. I go, all right, so the next time I walk into class, I say, seems like a lot of you were confused about X. Let me take a minute to clarify X. You do that, and you move on. Right? So it counts as active learning, because during that 1 minute, students were thinking about, what did Dr. Prince talk about today? What did I find confusing? So they're engaging with the material, but they're not listening with me and taking notes, so it counts as active learning. But it's also very useful feedback to me as an instructor. I figure out the most confusing point from that day's class, and I fix it the next time I walk into class and move on. It's a win-win. Okay? That's one variation of a one-minute paper. Let me give you another variation. I can ask, what was the most important point from today's class? What's the takeaway point from today's class? Again, I don't care if there are 200 students in my class. I collect them on the way out, and I skim through the first 20. Okay? And again, one of two things happens. Either pretty much everybody has identified the point that I think the main point was, in which case, I do nothing. Or I read through those first 20 and nobody has a clue. Nobody has identified the thing that I think is the most important thing from today's class, the thing that I really wanted you to walk away with. So I walk into class the next time and I say, and a lot of interesting responses on the one-minute paper. Most of you did not identify the thing that I really wanted you to take away from that class. Let me take a minute to clarify what the main takeaway was from my perspective as a professor, and then you do that and you move on. Same benefits, you know, engaging for them, useful to you. Last variation of the one-minute paper. You say, tell me one thing that I could change about my teaching that would make my class more effective for you. All right? And again, they'll tell me everything from, Dr. Prince, you speak way too quickly, because I do. All right? So that would remind me to slow down. Or they'll ask for more example problems or more visuals on the board or whatever it is that they think would make the class more engaging. Okay? So again, in all of those cases, it's a quick and simple activity that's useful for them and very, very useful feedback for me. Okay? So that's one thing I could do in three different flavors, all of which would count as active learning. Okay? I could do a simple brainstorm like I did with you in this particular presentation. I could walk into my heat and mass transfer class and say, today in class we're talking about diffusion. Diffusion is the transfer of matter due to a concentration gradient in a stagnant medium. I would like you to think about as many places as you can imagine where a chemical engineer would need to know something about diffusion and turn people loose for a minute and go. And again, one of two things will happen. Either they will identify a bunch of cool chemical engineering applications where diffusion is happening, which is great, so they now personally see the motivation of why we're talking about this in class. Or again, nobody has a clue. Nobody can think about why any rational chemical engineer would ever care about the diffusion of mass due to a concentration difference in a stagnant fluid, right? And so again, as an instructor, I can jump in and then clarify it. But, you know, people learn what they're motivated to learn, and relevance is a key component of motivation. So if they don't see the point of what you're talking about, they're going to engage less. So a simple brainstorm around applications can be engaging and wake them up and also get them to see the point of what you're talking about so they pay attention. Okay. You could do the activity that I shared from that research study, which is just stop talking. Just literally stop talking and say, look at your notes. If you have any questions, turn to a neighbor. Or if you want to say, look at your notes, identify a question that you want me to answer. I'm going to call on you in about 90 seconds. Make sure everybody has a question. You could do that. That is, but either one of those two things would qualify as active learning. Again, quick and simple to do. And based on that research study, I think surprisingly effective. I could have students generate a test question, which is something I sometimes do for homework, which is to say, I've been lecturing on the Navier-Stokes equations, fugacity, the second law of thermodynamics, whatever. You know, I've been droning on and on for the last 40 minutes or 3 days. I want you to think of a good test question that I could ask about this topic. Okay? And again, what students are going to do in response to that is they're going to step back and they're going to think, honestly, what has Prince been talking about for the last 40 minutes? What's the idea there? You know, what kind of problems can you solve with that? What sorts of questions can he ask? All right. If you're thinking about all those things, you're thinking about the topic, its relevance, what it's good for, how to do those things. You're thinking about the stuff that I want you to think about. So it's a good active learning technique. Again, it makes a fine activity in class. It also makes a fine homework problem. Okay, here's my personal favorite and the one that I use more often than anything else. All right. So I ask what I'll call a non-rhetorical question. And by non-rhetorical, I mean faculty ask questions all the time. But when faculty ask questions in a class, we tend to ask them in one of two ways. Right? Either we ask, does anybody have any questions? To which the response is,
no.
Yeah, just that. Right? Like, you know, avoidance of all eye contact, you know, embarrassed shuffling. The last thing that anyone wants to do in a room of 100 people is raise their hand and admit both, A, what they don't know, and B, that they care enough about thermodynamics to actually raise their hand and ask a question. So asking, does anyone have any questions, does almost nothing. All right. The second thing we do is I'll be lecturing on my thermodynamics class, and I'll say, I have an equal molar mixture of ethylbenzene and toluene. If I double the pressure, what happens to the fugacity of benzene? John. All right, his name's not John, but I don't know. All right, so first question. In that environment, what's John thinking about? If I call on John like that, what's he thinking?
Panic.
Why me? Of all the people in the room, why did Prince call on me? All right, what is everybody else in the room thinking? Yeah, thank God Prince did not call on me. All right, is anybody in the room thinking about fugacity? No, the question is a complete bust. All I've done is embarrass John. All right, so what could I do instead? Take the exact same question, all right, and say, in 90 seconds, I'm going to call on somebody. All right, turn to a neighbor and see if you can figure out the answer to that question. All right, and again, one of two things is going to happen. Either John's going to pair up with his neighbor, and they're going to figure out the answer to that question, in which case they own it. They get it. It's great. All right? And so John really feels like he's learned something and he knows something. Or John's going to turn to his neighbor, and they're going to figure out that neither one of them has a clue what fugacity is, never mind what the effect of pressure on fugacity is. But then when I call them and at the end of 90 seconds, it's a little bit less intimidating. You know, you can answer for the team and say, well, Maria and I were talking about it, and we thought this, but we weren't sure. All right? Doesn't matter whether they get the answer or not. The point is, for the next 90 seconds in my class, everybody is thinking about the effect of pressure on fugacity because they don't know who I'm going to call on. It's the exact same question, but it's a more engaging way of using that question. So it's a simple active learning variation of what we do anyway. Okay. Lastly, I don't know if in this series or in various workshops whether you've talked to people about writing instructional objectives for your classes. So this is the truth in advertising part. So have you already sat through workshops or presentations on writing instructional objectives? If no, just shake your heads vigorously no. Okay. If yes, if you have an instructional objective is just a list of things people should be able to do if they've learned the stuff that you want them to learn. So when I say, I'm teaching thermodynamics, what's the point of the course? When I say things like, well, I want you to understand thermodynamics, that's true, but it's useless from the point of view of educational design, because I don't know what that means and I can't assess it. All I can assess are things that are observable. So I can ask you, my instructional objectives might be to be able to explain in plain language what the laws of thermodynamics are and what they mean, to apply those laws of thermodynamics to design, you know, simple chemical engineering applications, you know, like pumps and compressors. That is things I could ask you to do. But if you have a list of instructional objectives, if you have articulated what it is people should be able to do if they've learned the stuff that you want them to learn in your class, any single one of those objectives becomes an active learning technique. That is, if you want them to be able to calculate the change in entropy of a stream given the change of temperature and pressure, that's an activity. Whatever you want, if you want them to be able to explain fugacity in plain language, that's an active learning activity. You just ask them to do whatever it is your objective says they should be able to do, and listen to what they tell you. Figure out where they're confused. Figure out where they're stuck. And then jump in as the instructor and get them unstuck. Okay? Here's the first pass. Let me pause for a second and ask an embarrassing question. Any questions on any of the things on the slide? Yes?
I have a problem with having the students generate test questions. Because mm-hmm. what happens with my students is if I don't use what they give me, the next time I ask them to participate, they're out of there.
Okay.
They're not
going to
engage.
So there's two variations that you can do on that. One is, of course, you don't have to say, I'm going to use your test questions. We should say, come up with good test questions. If they're good test questions, I'll use them. If I find them too trivial, I won't. But better than that is to actually clarify what it is that you're looking for in a good test question so that they know what they're shooting for, and to set up the grading structure so that the grading structure drives the creation of problems that, honestly, you would want to use because they are good problems. And in that environment, I think you'll get more problems that you honestly could use. The other thing that my friend Rich Felder does is he slips some of his own into the pile of student-generated questions and posts them all outside his office door and says, you know, the tests are going to be variations on these. Come look, but some of them are his. Okay. Depends how honest you want to be. All right. This is not an ethics workshop. This is a teaching workshop. Okay. All right. So that's simple active learning. Common faculty questions. If I talk about active learning for more than 2 minutes in a room of more than two faculty, I can pretty much promise that the following two questions are going to come up. One, how much time does it take to prepare these things? I'm busy. And trust me, I get it. You're busy. I'm busy. Secondly, if I do all those cute things, can I still cover the syllabus? So let's at least address those two, and then we can pause and take more of these concerns. But these are pretty common ones. First question, how much time does it take to prepare? All right, that's an interesting question. In the classes that I teach, what I tell my students is the answer to every interesting question is, it depends. All right. So the answer to that question is, it depends. But honestly, how long does it take to prepare? Often very little. I want you to think about the types of active learning I've talked about in this presentation this morning and the types that I've done with you. The first one from that research study, where the instructor just stops talking for 90 seconds and says, turn to her neighbor. If there's anything unclear in your notes, get some clarification. How much preparation time does that take me? Almost zero. The one-minute paper, stopping my class 2 minutes early and saying, take a minute and write down the muddiest point from today's class. How much preparation time does that take? Again, almost zero. My non-rhetorical question, that question about fugacity and pressure, all right, how much extra preparation time does it take? Almost zero. It's the same question I was going to ask anyway. Before, all I was going to do was embarrass John. Now I'm actually going to use it as an activity, but the preparation time is the same. All right? So the answer to how much time does it take to prepare active learning for your class depends. There are some types of active learning, like problem-based learning and cooperative learning, that honestly do take significant amounts of preparation time, especially the first time you redesign your class to incorporate that technology. So I will not tell you that active learning doesn't sometimes take time, but it doesn't have to. There are plenty of active learning techniques, every single one on that slide that I had, and some more that I could give you through readings, that take very, very little preparation time. Right? When I first started doing active learning as an instructor, all I would do is take out my lecture notes and take out a red pen and put an asterisk next to some spot where I thought it would be good to do an activity. And I might make a note, do brainstorm here or do open-ended question here. That was all the preparation it takes. Now I don't even do that. Now you look around the room and you go, I've lost them. A lot of glazed eyeballs, a lot of yawns, they're looking out the window, they're avoiding eye contact, they're not paying attention to me anymore. Time to do an activity, and I stop and do an activity. All right. So again, the preparation time can be very, very small. Initially, you might want some prompts in your notes, or if you have slides, you might want to work in an activity formally as a slide. But as you begin to do it, all you really need is about three techniques. That is, I don't want you to kind of do a brainstorm all the time, because that gets boring. But if you have three different techniques that you think suit your personality and style, and you trot them out in some variable pattern, that's really all you need to keep a class going. Okay, so that's the preparation time. All right, if I do all those things, can I still cover the syllabus? And again, the answer is yes. I'm talking about two or three activities lasting 1 or 2 minutes over the course of your hour lecture. That is, you're still lecturing 95% of the time. You can still cover all the stuff that you want to cover. All right, I'll simply remind you that coverage is not the goal. I can cover any amount of material you give me in any amount of time you want, including all of Wikipedia in 10 minutes. All right, as long as you let me flash PowerPoint slides at the front of the room at a subliminal pace, I can cover anything you want. All right, is anyone learning anything? Of course not. All right, but the point, the takeaway here, kind of the same thing, is the point of the quote from the beginning, which is, there's a difference between teaching and presenting, especially when you start this job. When you first start this job, really it's all about you. All you want is survival. The first time you walk into a classroom to teach a class, you just want to survive. And you'd like to have people think that you're not a complete idiot, that you know your stuff. Okay? And so all the focus is on, what am I going to do over the course of this hour? Do I really know my stuff? Can I explain it clearly? All right? And that's fine. You should do that for the first 2 years of your career. After that, you should have better thoughts than that. Because really, the point of teaching is not you. If you're in front of the room teaching thermodynamics, you already understand thermodynamics. That's why you're at the front of the room. All right? But the point of your class and the measure of the effectiveness of your class is not how well you know your stuff and how clearly you present it. The measure of your class is, how, at the end of that hour, how many people learned how much thermodynamics? Learning is the measure. All right? Coverage is not the measure. And I've shown you lots of studies, and I could show you lots more, where doing active learning actually results in more learning, which is, the point of our classes. Again, if coverage were the goal, I wouldn't be pushing it, but coverage is not the goal. That being said, I honestly cover as much and more in my problem-based learning heat transfer class than I covered before. So if you want to have that conversation about kind of content coverage beyond this, we can have that conversation. But there's absolutely no reason to think, in terms of active learning, that it has to suck up very much of your preparation time or will get in the way of your coverage at all. Both of those things are natural concerns, but they are very addressable concerns. Okay. Let me go through the three most common mistakes with active learning and then go back to some of your concerns and kind of have more of a dialogue. All right. That being said, about active learning is a technique, like anything else, and it can be done well, and it can be done poorly. So let me share with you what I think are the three most common mistakes that people make when they start doing active learning in their classroom. First one, they do an activity like that pressure fugacity question, and they always call for volunteers. All right, what's wrong with that? That seems like a nice, kind thing to do that's not going to embarrass anybody. What's wrong with just always calling for volunteers? Yeah. That is, John, my pre-med, who sits at the front right-hand corner of my room, who can answer any question I can ask before I've even finished asking the question. John's hand's already up, all right? So when I turn people loose to talk about fugacity and call for volunteers, everybody else in the room goes, Prince is going to call for volunteers. John's going to have his hand out. As soon as Prince starts talking, John's hand's going to be up, and John's going to know the answer because John's brilliant, all right? And so when I say turn to your neighbor, I don't have to turn to my neighbor and talk about fugacity. I can talk about basketball because there's no chance that the instructor is going to call on me. So don't do that. Cold call on people. And in particular, cold call on people at the back of the room. It's not cold calling because you've told them in advance that you're going to call on someone, and you've given them 90 seconds to actually think about it, and you've let them talk to somebody else. And the point is clearly not to embarrass somebody. But call on people directly. If you call on two or three people and none of them has the answer, then go to John, your pre-med, who can give you the answer so that it's not frustrating. But don't start that way, okay? So doing that will get more of the people to engage more of the time. Okay, won't get everybody to engage all the time, but it'll get more of the people to engage more of the time. Sometimes when I talk to faculty about active learning, they go, Mike, I tried it. It didn't work. And I go, I'm sorry to hear that. Tell me a little bit more. And what they'll say is, I'm teaching a room of 50 people, and I turn them loose for a turn to your neighbor activity. And I get these two guys at the back of the room who just won't turn to a neighbor. I say, turn to your neighbor, and they go, yeah, make me. All right, and they just won't do it. I walk over there. I've talked to them outside of class. They just won't do it. It's a failure. I go, all right, but let me get you to think about this in a different way. Go back and think about that slide that I showed you before about the number of people who are actually engaged in what you're talking about after 30 or 40 minutes of instruction. All right, 10% of the people are with you. 90% of the people are not. If in an active learning environment, 90% of the people participate and 10% do not, that is not failure, all right? 90% with me as opposed to 90% checked out is success, all right? There is no technique I could give you or that anyone else could give you that would work with every student all the time. If that's your bar for walking into a classroom, you will never walk into a classroom because there is no technique that comes with that guarantee. But personally, I like 90 to 10 in my favor a whole lot better than 90 to 10 against me. So even if not everybody engages, that's still a successful technique. Okay, that's mistake number one. Mistake number two is waiting for everybody to finish, which is I put up a problem on the board. All right, some people, John, is done in 2 minutes. The rest of the room takes 20, or some people take 20, right? And I wait for everybody to finish before I move on. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, two things are wrong with that. One, everybody's gotten up at 8 in the morning to come to my class, and John spent 18 minutes of that time twiddling his thumbs because he's done with the problem, and he's not getting anything out of those 18 minutes. So he's justifiably annoyed with me for wasting his time. Secondly, if I do two activities and they each take 20 minutes, I really won't cover my syllabus. And so it's a problem for everybody. So takeaway here is I don't need to wait for people to finish the problem. The point of using a question or posting a problem in active learning is not to get everybody to finish. The point of asking the question is to get you to think about it and engage. After 2 minutes, I can call on people to figure out where you are and where you're stuck and what questions you've had, and that's fine. If you're done, great. If you're not done, doesn't matter. But I don't need to wait for everybody to finish the problem. In fact, waiting for everybody will be bad. Okay. Last one, asking trivial questions. The Superman slide is from a workshop that I sat through on active learning where the facilitator asked, what's your favorite superpower and why is that your favorite superpower? Right? If you ask that to a room of engineering faculty or students, they're all going to roll their eyeballs with justification, which is this is a trivial activity and clearly has nothing to do with thermodynamics if I'm teaching thermodynamics. All right, most of us don't do that. But sometimes in active learning we do a variation of that, which is, I put you in a group of four people, and I give you 3 minutes to answer a question that any one of you could have answered on your own in 10 seconds. That is, if I'm going to put four of you together in a team and ask you to think about something and talk about it for 2 or 3 minutes, I should ask you to ask you a question that actually is worth three people's attention for 3 minutes of conversation. It should be a high-level outcome. It should be a creative thing. It should be something that really deserves the amount of time and the amount of people that I've devoted to it. So don't do cute cutesy, trivial things that really are not worth people turning to their neighbors. If you do, they're going to think, this is a waste of my time. I didn't get anything from this interaction at all, and they'd be right. Okay. I'm going to pause here because I've done the concerns, but we actually have a little bit more time, and I want to go back and collect some more of your concerns. So I've done the preparation time question, and I've done the coverage question. And I think I've answered them about as well as I can. Who has a concern that's a significant concern that would stop you from using active learning in your class that is worth taking some time to try to address? Okay. Yes?
Keeping the focus on teaching at, teaching at college level. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
it's not just troubles.
That's right.
So I turn them loose in the room to size in particular. And again, as a general rule of thumb, there's nothing you can do in a large room that you couldn't do better in a small room. That is, when I'm teaching 120, like I'm doing now, it's a whole lot easier when there are 12. But even with 120, what can I do? A couple of things. One, keep the activities short. So when the activities go 5, 6, 7 minutes, the longer it goes, the bigger the odds are that it's going to get diffused. Two, actually make the activities, the questions that you ask, engaging and interesting. Because again, the more interesting and engaging the question, the greater the odds are that people will engage. Three, call on people randomly, and really do call on people randomly so that there's a reasonable shot that people will get called on. Four, circulate around as much as you can. In this room, it's hard to circulate around in the middle, right? I can walk up this side, I can walk up that side, I can walk back and forth. That's really all I can do. But I can do that, okay? That combination of things is going to make things reasonable, especially if students figure out that the activities really are worthwhile and they're learning something. Will it be perfect? No, it will not be perfect. But again, perfection is not the goal, because if perfection were the goal, I would stay home. Okay. Yeah?
Have you ever had cases where business people are now called on randomly, they decide not to show up in class anymore?
I have not. But again, I teach in a different environment than many of you, which is I teach in an environment where the classes are smallish, and when you don't show up, I know, right? That is, so, Bucknell is a very small, private, personalized spot. So, and I have attendance policies. I didn't used to have attendance policies when it was just you, but now all my classes are team-based, problem-based learning classes, so that when you show up, you're not the only one who's penalized. And so, because of that reason, I have attendance policies. So, though honestly, I didn't have attendance policy problems before. You tell me. Do you guys have attendance problems at McGill in general? Okay. So again, so the next question is why, right? And if the answer is, well, students are making a rational choice, which is either my lecture notes are online or all I'm doing in class is regurgitating what's in the text. So I might as well just stay home and read the text. A lot of times faculty teach in such a way that students don't need to read the book and don't need to come to class, and then we complain that they don't read the book and they don't come to class. Well, students are just voting with their feet, right? I mean, people, for the most part, are semi-rational. If they're not coming to class, there's a reason for them not coming to class. My best answer is make the class worthwhile in terms of coming. Again, will active learning fix that problem? No, not entirely. But the more active you make your class, the more interesting you make your class, the more effective you make your class, the more people will come to your class. Yes?
You present the one-minute paper, and I think it's a great idea. For those of us that teach three-hour courses, though,
yep.
3 hours in a block,
yep.
I wonder if it's the one-minute paper turns out to be like a long thing, because I have a lot of stuff, so I don't know if it's an investigation.
Well, so again, I use a one-minute paper for eight-hour workshops, right? So it's not the block of time, because what you say is, think back on today's eight-hour workshop and identify the most confusing thing from today's workshop, the thing that I didn't clarify that you really wanted to clarify. So the fact that the workshop is 8 hours instead of an hour doesn't really change the technique at all. It doesn't have to be, 8 minutes because it's an eight-hour workshop. It's just you give them a minute. Does that answer your question?
Well, I was wondering, is it useful to do it, maybe within the block?
You can. The limiting factor is the speed with which you can read and process and adjust. So if you're an experienced professor and you've taught this class 6 times and there's nothing you can see that they're going to ask you that's going to cause you to stumble for more than 3 seconds. So I've been teaching heat transfer for 15 years. It's been 5 years since anyone's asked me a question that made me think more than 2 seconds, all right? Because you teach this stuff for a long time, it becomes very easy. When I first started teaching heat transfer, there's no way I would have done that technique on the fly because I just didn't know heat transfer well enough. So if you're an experienced instructor who can collect and process that information and adjust on the fly, Sure, you could do it during the 5-minute coffee break or 10-minute coffee break in the middle of your 3-hour class. If that's not you, don't do that technique. Do some other technique. Yes?
The things that you mentioned, I'm actually trying to fix what is happening in one class. Mm-hmm. So it's like, let's make a situation where you learn in spite of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you create the necessity or the motivation of the student to reach to another class? I found this to be a big challenge.
Yeah, and so, again, let me make sure I understand your question, which is, I want people to carry their learning from class to class to class, as I want, you know, my class builds on itself, right? And so I want people to actually remember and be able to use their stuff that they're learning in the previous classes as we move forward, right? Is that your question?
Yes, because you would ensure that you transmit information and retain something,
yeah.
But that is not necessarily enough to continue.
Absolutely. So there's a couple of things you can do. So one is, I can start my class by asking, so here's an active learning technique that you could use that would help. Again, not make things perfect, but help. As when you walk into class, you can take a minute and say, take out a piece of paper and jot down everything you remember from the last class. So people take out a piece of paper, and again, what you're looking for here is people learn a whole lot more when they're receiving information if their brains are already thinking about the topic when the information is coming in. So a lot of what I want to do at the beginning of a class is to get you thinking about, where were we last time? What were we talking about? So you're thinking about the stuff that, you know, I was doing in the last class, so that when I jump in, you're actually primed to take the new information and connect it to the old information. What a lot of us do instead is we walk in and we just assume that between Monday and Wednesday, my students have been thinking about my course content. Well, clearly they have not, right? And so I think that simple technique of getting them to go back and think about it is useful. That's a very simplistic answer to a much more nuanced, complex question, because the topic of retention and transfer, that's how do I get people in general to remember what they learn and to use it outside of the classroom context, is a question that I cannot answer in 30 seconds. There are answers to that question, but they don't fit in the context of a 30-second response here. So I would say catch me after the presentation if you want to talk about that more. Okay, yes?
So I teach in the Faculty of Management.
Okay.
I'm also a chemical engineer, and I'm a mic.
So okay, we have a lot of time.
Certain things in common. Yeah. Just a couple of comments and a question. One comment is, in the Faculty of Management teaching, a lot of this reflective learning principles that you've been talking about are routinely used.
Yep.
Reflective learning, problem-based learning and teaching.
Case studies.
Case studies and so on.
Yep.
And so you're translating that into techie courses,
right,
that are a little more dry and
sure,
straightforward.
Yep.
But one of the things that relates to that is you talk about thermodynamics. So mm-hmm. I know a little bit about thermodynamics, but making it relevant,
mm-hmm.
Trying to make it interesting for the student by answering the question, why does all of this really matter?
Right.
I mean, what difference does it make?
That's right. Yeah, because I wish I had a marker at the front of the front, and I don't. So otherwise, I would draw some. Here, let me steal one. So I don't know if you can see the board, but you know, a lot of times we walk into our thermodynamics classes and we pretend we're talking about things that are relevant and clear. And so I'll walk in and I'll say, well, today in class I want to introduce to you the concept of chemical potential. Well, the chemical potential is the partial derivative of the total Gibbs free energy with respect to the number of moles of components I, keeping TP and NJ constant. And clearly, this is the definition. I couldn't be more fundamental than that. Clearly, at this point, all of you see and understand the concept of chemical potential and why you would want to use it in your day job. All right. If you're confused, maybe you're confused because you've forgotten some of your basic thermodynamics. Maybe you don't remember what the Gibbs free energy is. So let me clarify for you that the Gibbs free energy, G, is defined as H minus TS, where H is the enthalpy and S is entropy. And again, I could go on pretending that all those definitions actually communicate something. They communicate nothing, all right? I mean, there is an idea there, and there's a real-world idea there that actually has some relevance in real-world applications. But trying to tease that out of this mathematical definition takes 20 minutes. It takes me 20 minutes to unpack what that math says. And as instructors, we almost never do that unpacking, right? We just assume that concept and its real-world application is obvious, where anyone in their right mind can look at that board and go, there is nothing obvious about the relevance of that concept at all to anybody. It's my job to make that clear. But initially, it is not clear. Yes?
The importance of having a balance between the pedagogy used. And my question would be, you know, when you go beyond the material,
right, okay. Right,
you don't just want your students to learn thermodynamics. You want them to learn how to learn at the end of the day.
Yep.
And do you think we do need more student-centered approaches to be able to get that data?
Right. A very personal question, which my answer is yes. So let me share with you, again, my own evolution as a teacher. I still remember the moment. I was teaching heat transfer, and I was lecturing to a group of about 30, 20-year-old students, and I was lecturing on how to calculate the heat transfer coefficient for turbulent flow perpendicular to a bank of tubes, which is what we talk about in the heat transfer class. And I look at this room of people, and it dawns on me. There's not a single person in this room who's ever going to have to calculate the heat transfer coefficient for turbulent flow perpendicular to a bank of tubes. And if they do, there's no way they're going to remember that from this class. I am wasting my time and theirs. There has to be a better use of the tradition, you know, the tremendous resources that are being poured into these people's education. What is it? All right. And so for me, the answer was, I was distressed by the huge gap between what students in the real world had to do to be successful as engineers and what they had to do in my class to get an A. And so I changed my teaching to make my class align more with what real people do. So the question was, what do real people do? Of these 30 people, none of whom are going to calculate heat transfer coefficients, what are they actually going to do when they leave? And my answer was, well, several things. They're going to have to learn how to solve open-ended problems, problems that they have not seen before, that have more than one answer and more than one way of getting there. They're going to have to be lifelong learners. They're going to have to learn independently, because I don't know where they're going when they leave Bucknell, but I know I'm not going with them. All right. So if all they do is learn from me how to learn from me, I am not giving them any favors, because I'm not going with them. And even if they know everything that I know, it's not going to be enough, because the world is changing fast. They have to learn how to work effectively with other people, and they have to learn how to communicate. So the reason why I've adopted, personally, problem-based learning as my preferred approach in my classroom is that problem-based learning is a technique that gives people the skills that they need in all of those areas. People learn anything. All right? I can take 100 years of educational research and condense it into the following sentence. People learn anything they're going to learn through guidance, practice, and feedback, whether it's learning how to speak French, or ride a bicycle, or solve partial differential equations, it doesn't matter. To learn, you need some guidance, some practice, some feedback. If I want you to learn how to solve open-ended problems, I need to give you some guidance, practice, and feedback on solving open-ended problems. If I want you to be a self-directed learner, I need to give you some guidance, practice, and feedback on being a self-directed learner. If I want you to have good interpersonal skills, there is very little I could get you to do on your own that would give you better interpersonal skills. To develop better interpersonal skills, you do need some guidance, which you can absorb on your own, but you need to practice them, and you need to get some feedback from other individuals. So that's a long answer to your question, but for me, it really was a transformative thought, which is looking at the mismatch between what I really thought was important, what my audience really needed, and what I was doing as an instructor in terms of my pedagogy. And that mismatch is really what got me to change a lot of my pedagogy. Yes?
I really like the activity comparing notes and what if students don't take notes.
Then they can just think about, you know, what has Prince talked about for the last 20 minutes that I found confusing, right? So if they don't, right, I don't use the note technique.
Is there any way of encouraging them
to take notes? It depends on how hard you want to push. So honestly, and again, I speak from personal experience. In high school, I never took notes. In fact, my high school chemistry teacher wanted to collect my notebook at the end of the year, and I said, honestly, I don't keep notes. I read the textbook, and I was one of those students who honestly did learn from a textbook. So I read the textbook, and I think I learned my chemistry just fine. Okay. So personally, I don't push notes because, you know, I think there are other things you can do.
But you post your course content on the course website.
I certainly have a bunch of stuff posted on my course website. My lecture notes are not on the course website. But again, with some irony, I lecture very little in my classes. I've lectured more this morning in the talk on active learning than I would lecture in a whole week in my heat transfer class. Okay. And again, I wanted to pause here because really, the concerns and addressing the concerns is really the bulk of what you get, you know, I think, in an initial presentation like this. That is, there are people here that you can work with. Once you've decided that you want to do some active learning techniques, that you're convinced that they can be quick and simple to do, they're not going to suck up a lot of your life, you can cover your syllabus, and the students are not going to lynch you. You know, if you're convinced of those things, you will find the resources on this campus and take the time to do it. If you're not convinced of those things, it doesn't matter how many resources you have here, you won't go find the resources and do it. So the reason why it's worth spending time on that topic is just for that particular reason, which is why I'm going to ask the question one more time. are there still people in the room that have some concerns that would be a barrier that would stop them from trying some active learning in their class? And don't be shy. 85% of the faculty across the country still primarily lecture. Lecturing is by far the most common technique. So if you're not doing active learning, you're in the vast majority of folks. So, you're not odd. Yeah.
Just the assessments, whether they're marching Yeah.
Right. So in the type of active learning that I'm talking about this morning, I would change absolutely nothing about my assessments, right? Because all I've done is this, I'm still lecturing. I'm just trying to make the lectures a little bit more active and engaging, but my instructional objectives have not shifted, and so my assessments have not shifted. In a PBL environment, that's a little bit different. There, my goals really are, how well can you solve open-ended problems that you haven't seen before? All right, so giving them a textbook problem on an exam in a closed book environment is not a good assessment of that. Right, so you're asking a very good question about kind of the rational design of assessments. Again, like your question, it's not a 30-second answer for that question. But I have two quick responses. One, in the context of this morning's presentation on active learning, you would change nothing at all about your assessment. If you like your assessments now, they would still be good assessments. The second one is, I'm a fan of authentic assessments, which is to put people in an environment which is as close to the real-world environment that you can as the instructor, and ask them to do the things that are the most authentic things that people would actually do outside of your classroom as an assessment about the effectiveness of your class. So if you're not doing that, so for example, if you're asking students to solve a closed book exam with three textbook problems in the context of a 52-minute exam, I will tell you that I've been doing chemical engineering since I've been 18, and I do a lot of consulting. No one has ever walked up to me and said, Mike, solve three textbook problems on your own in 52 minutes. That's not what engineers do. So if that's the sort of stuff you're asking, you might think about whether your assessments really are an authentic measure of learning outcomes that you care about. Your answer may be yes. All right, my personal answer is no, but your answer may be yes. And if so, you keep doing your assessments. But that's the question. What's the most authentic thing that I can do that's actually getting at stuff that's learning that's worth learning? Because there's always a tension between things that are accessible and things that are worth assessing. There are plenty of things that you could do that are quick and easy that are not worth doing because they don't tell you anything. And then the things that you really want that are hard to assess. But I would say we do the best job we can trying to get at the things that are worth assessing rather than assessing things that aren't worth assessing. Yes?
You might have answered this in one way or another. What if the skeptics are the students you're teaching?
Yeah, and they sometimes are, right? So I want you to imagine the following scenario. Bucknell is a private university. Tuition and fees next year crack $60,000 to come to my university. All right, so priceless. I know I'm priceless, but still, you could put a price on me, and $60,000 might be more than you're willing to spend for some time with me in the classroom. So I have people who are spending lots and lots of money, and they walk into my heat transfer class and my thermodynamics class, and I ask them the effective pressure on fugacity, and I say, turn to a neighbor, and John says, look, I don't know anything about my neighbor here, but my neighbor is just as clueless about thermodynamics as I am. There is no way I'm spending $60,000 a year to come sit in your classroom to learn from this bozo. I'm here to learn from you, right? So you need an answer. One, that's a common response, and two, you need an answer to that question. And again, my answer is, I am not having you turn to your neighbor to learn thermodynamics from the person who is also a student in the class. I'm having you turn to a neighbor to figure out what questions you have. What can you do? Where do you get stuck? What do you understand? What are you confused about? And that conversation is meant to get you to recognize what you understand and what you don't understand, and to make that visible to both you and me, so that I can then jump in and do as the instructor what my job is to do as the instructor, which is to help you. But to help you, you need to know the help you need, and I need to know the help you need. And I can't see inside your brain. All I can see is what you tell me. So I'm going to do something to make your thinking as visible as I can and respond to it, which is why I do active learning. Yes.
You're very well established or tenured. What happens to a younger person who is in the first 2 or 3 years of this business and the reaction is positive or negative?
That's right.
Other faculty members?
Right. So for people who are early on in their career, again, I'm very sympathetic. The first time you are teaching a class, your goal really is survival, right? There are a few things more exhausting and time consuming than putting together a class for the first time. And again, we could talk about ways to make that better, but it would be more than the 30-second answer to your question. But if you are young in your career, then I would have you focus on the things that I've talked about here. I would not have you do problem-based learning, which really does suck up a lot of your time, which really does generate a lot of student resistance, and which really does generate questions which you are not prepared to answer yet because you are teaching the class for the first time. But again, pedagogies are tools. Don't use that tool. There are other tools. Simple active learning of the approach of the sort that I'm talking about this morning. One of my research areas has become student resistance because it's clear that it's one of the barriers for faculty. Somewhat surprisingly to most people in the room, by far, the published studies on attitudinal responses to active learning are positive. That is, when you look at studies on active learning, the student attitudinal response is positive. Right? That does not mean that I believe that we don't get student resistance. Partly, A, because I get some, and B, there's ridiculous response bias in some of those studies, which is when I do a survey of faculty, the people who like it and have been doing it are the ones who respond. The faculty who don't like it, you know, don't. All right. So student resistance is a real potential issue. But think about the stuff that I've talked about this morning, all right, and think about whether it would honestly generate a lot of student resistance. If you ask the students in your class to take a minute at the end of your lecture and jot down the thing that they found most confusing, and if you took the time to read those things and took 1 minute out of class the next time to actually address their question, is that likely to generate student resistance? My suggestion is no. You've taken a very small amount of class time. You've only asked them to tell you where you're confused, and you've taken the time to address their concern. All right? That is, most of these techniques are short, they're simple, and the goal is to make the class more engaging and more effective. Honestly, that type of active learning generates very, very little student resistance and doesn't take much of your time. It actually is good advice even for beginning teachers. All right? So avoid the stuff that's going to get you in trouble, but plenty of this stuff will not get you in trouble. Yes?
I would ask you a question about, and then comment on one of your comments.
Sure.
I fully agree with what you have said now about what you call it active learning. But basically, what you said makes sense, and I don't find it's good practice more than a new technology.
Sure.
Right. So.
Yeah. Nothing radical this morning.
Anything more than that, but anyway, it is it's reasonable. Mm-hmm. You asked the question about why do you think it may not work?
Mm-hmm.
And here is where I disagree with you, because when we when some of the audience said some of the reasons why they the students may not come to class, mm-hmm. or something like that. So you answered that why wouldn't they come to class? Mm-hmm. Because either you are repeating what is in the book, or you are doing something else. And this is where I have big problem, because it seems like this is becoming a theory that if the student is not coming to class, then it must be the
must be my fault.
Yeah, it is. And so I will give you only two examples where the student may not come to class and it has nothing to do with the professor.
I don't even need the two examples. I agree with you entirely that there are plenty of times that students don't come to class that have nothing to do with the faculty member. But let me ask you a related question, which is, frame it in a certain way. That is, I don't think that student learning is the sole responsibility of the faculty member. I think that's an irrational process. That is, learning is a shared responsibility. As people in the room have a responsibility, I have a responsibility. But as the instructor, I only control me. I don't control them. So what I do is all the things that I can do to make that situation better. So the things that I can do is make the class worthwhile, make it engaging, make it effective. That's not going to change the fact that you're working 40 hours a week on a job outside of class and you can barely pull yourself together to come to my class. That's not going to change the fact that you have a drug dependency problem or that you're depressed. All right, so all those things I can't change. But my response is I'm going to do the things that I can do, and active learning is one of those things that I can do to make it better, recognizing very fully that it is not going to get at all the problems that we have as instructors, and some of them really are outside of my control. Yes?
Well, the flip side of that is presenteeism. I mean, students that come to lecture,
yep.
but basically are there physically, but
that's right.
are mentally somewhere else.
Which is far more common, right? That is, most of our students show up to most of our classes most of the time, right? Like that's my assumption. Oh, okay, okay. Okay. Did you want to follow more? It's okay.
No, but because I would have preferred, yes, that you asked, that you say that there is many, it's not only professor and student, but there is also administration. You said something very administration and many other factors that that are coming to play. Right. You said that you are coming from a small university with a small number of students.
Right.
And we have this example here. We know every year Mount Allison is one of the smallest universities, and it always has excellent record in teaching because of this.
Right.
When you come, at least you can see that the efficiency of this active learning will decrease with the increase of the number of students in the...
Not necessarily.
Maybe linear, I don't know, but definitely the number of students in the class will affect this method.
So because let me pause and interject.
The students are very not heterogeneous,
right,
are not homogeneous, right, they are heterogeneous, and the levels are coming from different countries with different culture and so on, many factors.
Right. Okay, but again, what I'll say is you have a lot of assumptions in that statement, some of which are borne out by research, some of which are not. That is, there are lots of studies on active learning in very large classes, up to about 1,400 students, that show the same sort of learning gains that I've talked about this morning. That is, I agree. I think it's much easier and less intimidating to do active learning in a small room, but it can be done very well in a large room. Same thing about heterogeneity. That is, all of us have mixed students. All of us have students who are more motivated and less motivated, more bright and less bright. And that's a real challenging teaching issue. What do I do with a room of people who have very different backgrounds and very different motivation levels and very different abilities? And the answer is nothing perfectly, but I want you to look at two different environments. Environment one, the environment in which you teach, if you're teaching traditionally, what are you doing for that? And the answer is absolutely nothing. That is, there's one of you teaching at one level, at one pace, because it's you as the instructor controlling the level and the pace. When I say turn to a neighbor and talk about the effect of pressure on fugacity, the people who are brighter are having a different conversation than the people who are less bright. That is, I haven't fixed the fact that there are mixed abilities in my room, but I've made it better because people will engage at the level that they're capable of engaging at. So again, and I said the same thing lastly in terms of your administration issue, which is, yeah, there are all kinds of factors that affect learning. But the question for you is, how many of those do you control? And the answer is, you control some, but not all. So you work on the ones that you can control, and the ones that you can't, you can't. All right? So, yes? All right. Let me take that thought as a transition point, because we'll have one more time for open conversations. One, let me kind of... I want to ask a slightly different flavored question. We can go back to the original one, but there's another question I want to talk about, which is, okay, summarizing where I've been this morning, active learning is a broad thing, right? And there really is a flavor for everybody. If you want to be mostly traditional, you can be mostly traditional. If you want to be radical, you can be radical. If you want to be somewhere in the middle, you can be somewhere in the middle. If you like technology, you can use technology. If you're like me, a Luddite, and you don't like technology, you cannot use technology. You can fit in anywhere. And again, I would say plenty of research that shows it works. And in fact, that research is so overwhelming and so compelling that the National Science Foundation is never going to spend another dollar looking at whether active learning is more effective than traditional lectures, because it's not an interesting research question anymore. That question has been asked and answered hundreds of times. All right? So it really, anyone who wants to honestly look at the data can see for themselves that active learning is more effective than a traditional class. And again, it's not even an interesting question anymore. Okay? It's easy to do, or it can be. That is, some active learning techniques are complicated. Some of them require technology. Some of them are hard to do in rooms like this. Some of them require experience. But some of them do not. Some types of active learning are really quick and simple. And that's the ones I focus on this morning. So that's the question, which is, if there's a flavor for everybody, if it works, if it's easy to do, why is lecturing so still so pervasive? All right, and that's kind of the conversation that I want to generate. I'll do a little background slides again, but that's the question I want you to think about. You tell me why you think this is still so pervasive. Okay. One of the things I look at are barriers to the diffusion of innovations. And so when you ask faculty that question more broadly, these are the sorts of things that show up in faculty surveys. What they say is, one, I'm not convinced of the effectiveness. All right? So we can talk about that. But I'll tell you honestly, if you're a data-driven person, the data is very clear. They're worried about class time in terms of coverage of the syllabus. They're worried about preparation time because they're busy. And they're worried about student resistance. All right? All of these are very easy to address. This one's a little bit more complicated. Student resistance is a more complicated thing where we honestly could use a little bit more research. And again, I'm spending some time starting to do some research in that area. Okay. I think the problem is in part, I hate to say it, the problem is me. All right. So by which I mean, that is, we've taken a very naive view in terms of getting faculty to change. And let me share again some of my own naivete, both as a teacher and as a faculty developer. When I first started teaching, my fairly naive view of teaching was, as long as the person in front of the room knows what they're talking about, and as long as they say it clearly, and as long as the students in my class show up and pay attention, they will build up the expertise that I have. And what I would say is, that model is a silly model. We have decades of cognitive research that say, really, that learning does not work that way. We'll talk about that more this afternoon. I say my faculty development efforts were similarly naive. What I thought was, well, faculty, especially engineering faculty, are data-driven. When I show them data that says, you know, here's some data, active learning is more effective than lecturing, they're gonna think about stopping lecturing and starting doing active learning. That's a pretty naive thought. I mean, you tell me what happens instead. If I walk, I want you to picture the oldest, crustiest, most curmudgeonly faculty member that you can think of in your program, the one who's been lecturing for 35 years, all right, very traditionally. And I want you to imagine walking up to that person and saying, look, turns out that the way you teach is bad, and that active learning would be much better. All right, here, I have a research study that shows that active learning is better. You give that study to that person. Tell me what you think is going to happen. That's right. One, you run for your life. All right. Thank God that person's old and can't catch me because, you know, really he wants to kill me. So let me share with you the conversations that I have, because, you know, this is what I do now. So it always starts with data, because faculty like to pretend we're data-driven even though we're not. So if I say, you know, I want to talk about active learning, let me share with you, I'll share two. I have a colleague back at Bucknell who said, well, Mike, if you want me to change, you need to show me data. Again, we like to pretend we're data-driven. So I say, Tim, that sounds great. I have data. Let me give it to you. He says, Mike, I can't trust your data. I mean, you know, you have a known point of view. You could be cherry-picking. Maybe there are studies that work and studies that don't, and you're just giving me the ones that work. I go, okay, that's fine. Why don't you go look at the literature? Tell me what you find. I'll take you to lunch. We'll talk about it. He says, Mike, I'm busy. I don't have time to go look at the educational literature to find that stuff. So again, I want you to think about what he's saying. Every single thing that person is saying is true and rational. He really does need data to change. If I want you to change, you need a reason to change. So wanting data is a rational thought. You can't trust me, really. You shouldn't trust me. All right. So I could be cherry-picking my studies. So you really should go look for yourself. And three, you really are busy. You don't have time necessarily to go comb the educational literature. Every single one of those statements is true and rational. But what they've done is they've set up a perfect environment where that person doesn't have to change. They need data, they won't take my data, and they won't get their own data. So they've set up a situation where it's impossible for them to change, and so they can continue doing what they're doing while pretending to be data-driven, because they've set it up so that there's no way they can change. Let me give you the other variation that happens much more commonly, which is, you know, people will say, well, Mike, if you want me to change, I need data. Again, that's the common starting point. And you walk up to them with a study that says, sure, here's some data. What they say is, they poke at it. They go, do you see how they picked the control group in that study? That was a that was a quasi-experimental design. That wasn't a truly randomized sample. You can't tell anything from studies like that. That's worthless. So you walk up to them with a study that they like better. And they go, okay, you know, here's one. The methodology is better. And they go, Mike, that's one study. You can't tell anything from one study. I mean, I can find a study that says anything. All right, so you take the time and you go off and you find 10 studies that have a good methodology, and you bring it up to the faculty member, and they say, Mike, none of those people are teaching thermodynamics at McGill. My environment is different than any of the environments in any of these studies. There's nothing about this data that really translates to me. By which I mean, it doesn't matter how much data you show people. That is, it is not about data. Right? People who are truly data-driven, if you're honestly data-driven, you don't just poke holes at the data on one side. If you're truly data-driven, you look at the evidence on both sides. I ask you, how much evidence do you have for the way you're teaching now? What studies support it? How good are those studies? How did they pick the control groups in those studies? What about the methodology in those studies? All right? And what you find is almost nobody has any studies to support what they're doing now. All right? But if you're data-driven, you need both. I mean, it's fine to be skeptical, and it's fine to be critical. But that means that you look honestly at both sides of the issue and look at the data on both sides. And that's not what people do. Okay. I think the issue is much more emotional than it is cognitive. That is, change is primarily an emotional process and not a cognitive process. Change is about letting go of something that you're comfortable with, right, that seems to work for you, and grasping after something else where you're not quite sure what that something else is, and you're not sure that it's going to work, and you're really worried it's going to blow up in your face, and it just makes you uncomfortable. And that emotional barrier is really, I think, a much more significant barrier to getting people to change than the data question. Again, the engineers almost never talk about their feelings because as a cohort, we don't like talking about our feelings. But change, I think, is primarily more about our feelings than it is about data. All right. With that being said, I want you to tell me. All right. So again, my guess is that McGill is like most places, which is that most of the instruction going on is still fairly traditional. And again, I've shared a bunch of data with you this morning. I could share lots more. Most of that data is not new. We've known for a long time. And frankly, our own common sense usually tells us that anything that we can do that get people to actually think in our classes, to actually engage in our classes, would be more effective than passively listening to us talk for any extended period of time. That is, both common sense and data tell us we should do something else, but we don't. So you tell me, why don't we? Yes?
Just a couple quick reactions. I teach project-based learning courses. Mm-hmm. I deal with the confusion and uncertainty and emotional consequences of doing that. And I think that that's absolutely essential. That the people I want to train need to be able to deal with uncertainty and emotion and confusion and all of those things, the collaborative work. I also recognize that there's a craft of lecture. And some of my most memorable learning experiences are associated with people who had perfected that craft and were really brilliant and wonderful and could weave together a narrative just as you focused our attention on certain things and wove a narrative together for here. So I'm a little concerned that you started by saying there's a flavor for everyone and we shouldn't be throwing out the lecture.
That's right.
And it's a very, very effective tool.
Right. And I think that thought is what generates, I think, some of the resistance. Because sometimes what faculty hear when you talk about active learning is, you're telling me that lecturing is evil. You're telling me that lecture doesn't work. You're telling me that lecturing is bad. All right. But again, that's not the message of active learning. Again, if you look at what I did with you this morning, I lectured more often than not. So typically in a presentation or a workshop, you model whatever pedagogy you're trying to convey. So in this particular pedagogy, it's 90 to 95% lecturing with a little bit of something to make it more engaging. The last thing I'll say on that one is, there are plenty of people, or certainly some gifted individuals, who really can hold the attention of a room of people for an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours. In my experience, most of those people are not engineering faculty. Yes?
I was told about 120.
Students.
Oh, students? Sorry, students, raise your hand.
Just a handful.
But the objective is to students to learn, is that correct?
Yes.
So what is the purpose? We're talking about teaching, but the objective is not teaching, it's learning.
That's right.
So I guess that we need more students in this room to be able to...
Well, except that students don't necessarily have the authority to craft the environment in the classroom. That is, as an instructor, you have more influence and authority than any single individual to craft the structure... Okay, I'm not disagreeing with that.
The emotion that we're talking is regarding the teacher, plus regarding the student. So they need some change of culture, change for the student. Plus we have to process the change ourselves also as a teacher or as an instructor.
Yeah, so again, going back to the issue that came before, you're learning is a shared responsibility. So the audience for this talk this morning, I actually think, is the right audience, which is, this is a talk geared to, as a faculty member, what can I do? What are some of the things that I could do to impact learning? For students, it's a related but different conversation, because we can have the same conversation with students, which is, what do students need to be doing differently to improve the effectiveness of the classes that they're taking with us? And those are both good conversations, and they're related conversations, but they are somewhat separate conversations. Yes?
To extend on this aspect, I think there's something very essential here.
Do you find that you have to explain the technique, what you're trying to achieve, to the student themselves?
Somewhat.
And once they are exposed to it, do they become better learners?
Yeah. So if you're thinking of walking into a classroom and doing something that's very out of the mainstream for the environment in which you're in, it is worth taking a minute or two on the first day of class to explain what you're doing. So you might say, in this class, you know, I'm going to primarily lecture, but every so often I'm going to stop lecturing. I'm going to ask you to do something, sometimes on your own, sometimes in groups of two, sometimes in groups of three, to get you to think about what I'm talking about. I am not torturing you. I'm not doing an experiment on you. Those experiments have been done. Right? The reason why I'm doing it is that I have lots of data to show that, in general, when we do this, you will learn more, your grades will be higher, you will be more satisfied, and I will get the feedback that I need from you to be a more effective teacher. If you'd like to see that research, come see me. All right. You will not live long enough to have a student come ask you for that research. But but it's nice to have some. All right. So you can whip up my paper on active learning or something similar. But yes, I think it's worth explaining to people early on what you're doing and why, and to the degree to which it is non-traditional, to the degree they're going to look at you like, really, who is this bozo and why is he asking me to do that? If that's what you think the concern is, then take a minute to diffuse that concern. Yes.
We'll say yes or no, and then the gentleman's head. Yes.
Okay. I'm just wondering, do you need to have some sort of consistency in the way you're in different professors speak? Because you did say that, you know, it basically comes down to your choice. But what I see is that I teach both project oriented courses, mm-hmm. and the one that is more traditional, and the way the students perceive mm-hmm. good things that come out of those two courses are very different. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, in the project-based course where I act like a good parent trying to direct them and so on, so they take all the credit to themselves, you know, they're very happy with the course, you know, but I don't get any kind of official recognition. On the other side, you know, when I try to bring some of these more interesting approaches to my more traditional course, they would usually tell me that they would focus, as many engineers, on calculations, and if you don't give them calculations, they would not see necessarily that they are learning something.
Right.
So again, there's lots wrapped in that question. Let me pick the easiest part first, and then I'll duck the rest unless you poke me more. The first question was, is there any value in consistency in terms of approach? The short answer is, not really. It's helpful to you, that is, if you're doing active learning in your classes, if you're doing some project-based learning or problem-based learning, which is a departure from what most people see. It's easier on you if you have more colleagues doing what you're doing and if people have had that environment before. So in my own personal experience, I find that the very first radical course that students take is a hard one on the instructor, where they have to go through all that emotional change about their expectation. After the first one, it gets easier. So the other piece of advice for people, for the more junior faculty members in the audience, is get a more senior faculty member to teach in a more radical pedagogy in the prerequisite to your class, so that you're not the first person who's doing this in your class, because it will make your life a whole lot easier if someone else is doing it. Okay. Yes?
Yeah, my question, I guess, is getting back to the theme of change and emotion. One of the reasons why I started using active learning was I was doing traditional lecturing, and I was tired of seeing the glazed over eyes, and at the end of my class, I didn't feel good. You know, it was like a bad emotional beat.
Yep.
I wanted to try to get the students more active, and it seems to work, and I thought, well, in the end, that's the ultimate motivation for me, sort of like you spoke of your personal thing.
Right.
But I wondered, is there any study or evidence about emotion or maybe student evaluation? The evaluation of the professor, I mean, that relates to active learning. I mean, because that would ultimately be a drive for the person who, say, doesn't want to buy the statistics, but if he knows he's going to get better evaluations, more motivated.
It's a great question. And in fact, my last funded proposal, for that proposal which got funded, I had to go look at the literature about what we knew about student evaluations and active learning, especially in an engineering context. There's not lots and lots. I found 20 studies that looked at student attitudinal responses to active learning in an engineering context. The vast majority of those were positives. Not all of them looked at student evaluation. Some of them used other measures. So I think the data that exists is supportive of the idea that students will, in general, like it. But I think what's not compelling is, one, there's not a lot of studies, And two, I think there's a suspicion of at least publication bias or response bias in terms of kind of the situations that were chosen. So we have not done truly randomized samples of looking at people doing active learning and looking at attitudinal responses for undergraduate engineering students. We have done some of that for, say medical school students, in different audience, a little bit more mature, and there the attitudinal effect sizes are actually the largest effect sizes, so 0.8, which is a pretty large effect size. But you know, an 18-year-old engineering student is different from a 25-year-old med student. Yes?
I'm one of the few students in the room, and I just have a quick comment that I have realized that one of the good things that learning always does is it makes students very hard. So they have to know what their ignorant offer and what they know. Being able to discuss, being able to have a session, being able to question whatever. So that always helps. That you're more willing to learn and you're more comfortable in your ability. So you know that this is something you don't know. One question I have is that given that the level of motivation when you're sitting in class varies between as you go through the years from master's to PhD,
right.
Do you think that, and also along with that, given that one of the underlying reasons for promoting active learning is to increase level of attention from students, do you think that that 10 to 12 minute bar that you show, 10 to 12 minutes in that break and then 10 to 12 minutes, that kind of changes from your system over the years, depending on what classes you're teaching?
Yeah. I would say honestly not so much. Yeah, so again, it's a rational thought that I think turns out to be not so much true, which is, you know, the 10 to 12 minute, you know, attention span issue is a general human issue. It's not that, you know, sometimes I talk to faculty and they go, oh, kids today, they spend all their time multitasking, it's getting a whole lot worse. It might be getting worse, but even for the graduate students in class, or even for faculty at workshops, or for the very bright, motivated people who, you know, pulled themselves out of their busy schedule to come here and listen to me this morning, we all have attention spans of about 10 or 12 minutes in terms of taking mental vacations. So it's not something that goes away as you get older. There are more advanced pedagogies like problem-based learning that are easier to pull off in graduate school, not because your attention span has changed, but because you see your role in the learning process differently. As in graduate school, you've chosen to be kind of an independent researcher within a discipline. You've assumed that I have a very active role in learning this material and I want to contribute to that field. And so you're not resentful when I ask you to solve an open-ended research problem. When you are 18, just epistemologically, a lot of 18-year-olds, and for those of you who are familiar with Perry's scale and people's intellectual development, but most 18-year-olds are dualist, meaning they think every question has a right answer and a wrong answer. There's a single right answer and a bunch of wrong answers. They think your job as a professor is to know that answer and to tell you that answer clearly. That's how they think knowledge is constructed. That's what they think knowledge is. When you walk into a PBL class and they ask me, what's the answer to that question? And I say, it depends. They think I'm a bad professor because a good professor would know. There is one answer to that question, and a good professor would tell me the answer to that question. That's the piece that gets harder earlier on in the curriculum. I have to actually change what you think of what knowledge is and how you learn and what my role is and what your role is. That creates real tension. Okay, one of my main jobs as a speaker is to make sure I don't keep you here longer than you should be kept here. I'm looking at the clock, and actually I think it is time for me to call it formally to a close. Anyone who has a question that I have not addressed can either come down to see me at the front of the room, or I am speaking, I don't remember where and when this afternoon, but I am speaking somewhere this afternoon, and I'm sure it's on the schedule somewhere. Come see me again. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Just like to thank Michael very much for giving this fantastic and very engaging talk this morning, and for having modeled some of the techniques. So in recognition, we have a very nice piece of the spoke tailoring from Miguel Engineering. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
And, also, I'd also just like to make sure that the people who actually did all the hard work in organizing this get thanked. So I'd like to thank Maria Ojeda and all her hard work, not just today, but for the last couple of years with the Teaching and Learning Enhancement Program. I'd like to thank Laura Weiner from Teaching and Learning Services and all the other staff there, Professor Lawrence Chen, who did a lot of work to get this started. And also I'd like to underline again the very generous support of the Teaching and Learning Enhancement Fund, which is having a transformative impact here at McGill Engineering. So thanks very much, everyone, for coming. And please come back again next time we have an event. Thank you.